This is CliffCentral.com.
All right, CliffCentral.com on a Monday morning. We are here to keep you company and helpful in your day with interesting information, some of the news, some of the things everybody's talking about. Your calls on 0861-555-189. It's Monday. Well, where do we begin? You know Prince Philip had that accident, right? No, everybody's
the
talking about
the memes.
Yeah, there's so many fun memes coming out. And hilarious stuff around just the fact that a 97-year-old caused such a horrendous accident and then got out of the car and just walked home. And he hasn't apologized to the people who he injured.
No.
I saw a story in the news last night. You could tell me if it's true or not, Leanne. This woman says she's going to sue.
Good.
She wants some money from Prince Philip because he hasn't apologized to her. He didn't say anything after the accident. He walked away.
Yep. One woman has a broken wrist. There was a kid in the other car who thankfully wasn't harmed, but it was being driven by another woman.
He doesn't care, huh?
Not even an apology, not even a well wish.
Nothing.
Nothing. So he's been given a bit of a stern talking to by the police because he wasn't wearing his seatbelt.
Yeah.
And they said, look, this needs to change if you're going to continue driving because, of course, his new car's arrived.
Yeah. Already?
Yes.
Brand new car. It's good to be the king.
I don't know. It's just like he doesn't give a shit about anything.
He doesn't. And
he doesn't know how to.
Of course not.
He never felt he ever should.
Well, if you were married to the Queen, and before that you'd been born a prince, and you don't owe anyone an explanation because you think they're all peasants anyway. Why would you need to apologize to this dreadful-looking woman who, by the way, if you look her up on the internet, you'll see she really doesn't look like the kind of person that Prince Philip would ever condescend to even talk to, let alone apologize to. So good luck to her. I don't think she'll get a cent. In fact, she'll be lucky if he doesn't come to her house and shoot her with his shotgun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh man, what a weekend. I was talking about this with so many people. Everybody seems fascinated by the fact that Prince Philip just drives around at high speed all over the place at 97. Everyone was talking about it. Alright, well, there are some other things that are worthy of a bit of discussion this morning, and I'm sure that you'd have something to say about it. If you do, you can call us. We've got our phone lines working, I'm excited to say. 0861-555-189. But before we get into that, let me just remind you that at 8 o'clock this morning, we bring you another episode in our series, For the Love of Law, where we take you behind the desks of some of South Africa's smartest lawyers. If the law is like war, then you need cover fire and sniper fire. Well, Saul Shoot, forgive the pun with his surname, is like a guided missile. He's a graduate from BITS, a director of Fluxman since 97. Saul has a wide range of expertise from constitutional law, defamation, commercial high court litigation, arbitrations, business rescue, advertising, and medicine law. You can find out more at cliffcentral.com and take a listen just after 8 o'clock this morning. You'll be able to hear what Saul has to say. Good morning, cliffcentral.com. You're on the air. Hello. Hey. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Hey, there it works. What's going on? Who's this?
It's Jonty.
Isn't it weird how I always get excited when like the phones work. It's such a small thing. The reason we wanted Jonty Searle to talk to us this morning is because on Friday Leanne had a story about the male G spot and how supposedly easy it is to locate.
No, just how short the article was. You know, when you read articles about women's G-spots, they go on for pages, and it's this whole mystery. And with men, it was like two paragraphs. It's there. Go for it.
Is it that easy, Jonty? You're the sexpert. You're CliffCentral.com sexpert. Is it that easy to find the male G-spot?
Yes, it is, but you have to do it with real care. That's kind of the corollary, because it's very, very sensitive. And it might take a little bit of time to locate. So do you want a step-by-step guide on how to do this, or what's the direction of the conversation we are having?
Sure, of course. Should we be in a particular position while you advise us?
Yeah, the best position is either lying on your back with your legs over your partner's thighs, was a pretty good one.
On my back with my legs over my partner's thighs. Got
so she or he would be sitting between your legs.
Right.
Or a very relaxed position is lying on your side with one leg kind of crossed in front of the other.
One leg crossed in front of the other. Wow, okay, all right, I got you. Right.
Okay. So you need to have a conversation first because you need to be very clear on what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody needs to be on the same page.
Right.
And you need to have an understanding of what you're going to do. And you need to set up some words about slow down, stop, allow me to feel what's happening before you go further.
All right.
Are really, really important.
And you want a relaxing atmosphere. You don't want everybody all worked up and nervous, right? You want everyone knowing what's going to happen.
Absolutely. The more relaxed you are, the better, the easier, and the more successful this will be.
All right. So now we're relaxed. We're communicating. There's an open flow of information, and you're in the position that you've just given us, one of those two positions. Now what?
We need lube, some really good lube.
Right.
And some people are comfier with a rubber glove or a latex glove.
All right.
And that's okay, too. Short nails, no rings. This is not S&M 202.
Right. We're not going to hurt that sensitive area. Good.
No, because for a lot of men, if they've had any kind of prostate exam or they've been to a urologist, that's not touched gently.
Mm.
And because there's so much kind of taboo around the anus anyway,
right?
And in the Western world, we're a real bunch of tight asses. We hold an enormous amount of tension there.
Yes.
So it has to be approached very gently.
All right. Are there other parts of the world where they're not so tight-assed?
There are parts where we're kind of less. But as a generalization in the Western world, that's kind of what we are.
All right, John T., we're ready for you. Go on, insert.
Okay. So, no. You don't insert straight away. Lots of playing around the outside. So just making circles, crossing the anus with your thumb, playing in that whole area very, very gently. And as you do that, the relaxation will deepen. That's a good idea for the man to be breathing deeply. Just focusing on slow, deep breaths in and out.
All right.
And then when you're going to start to go inside, a really beautiful way to do that, it's called ringing the doorbell. So you just kind of pulsate your finger against his anus. Just pulsate,
ding
pulsate,
dong.
Pulsate. That's it.
Okay.
Like, hello, I'm here.
Go.
And slowly, it will start to open and you'll be able to go in. You need to do this slowly and you need to be communicating. Again, that's really important, that if it feels uncomfortable, just stop and breathe and be aware of what's happening, because often there'll be a lot of releases, a lot of relaxation, kind of step by step along the way.
All right.
Okay, and then what you're looking for is on the upper wall of his anus. That's the side of his anus is rectum facing his belly.
Right.
That's important. Like, you're not looking in the direction of the spine.
Okay.
Because you're not going to find anything there.
Right.
And as you go in, it's probably, you're generally going to go about the depth of two knuckles.
Two knuckles, right.
Everyone
just looked at their hands. Everyone.
Yes.
Ah, okay.
Of course they did.
Two knuckles.
It might be for some men a little bit deeper, a little bit shallower. Cause it's not like this is it for everybody.
Sure.
And if you stroke in that area, it might take a little while to kind of wake up. You'll start to feel under your fingers a structure that's there. And generally, the way it's described is about the size of a walnut.
Okay.
An unopened walnut.
Got you.
Now, it's very, very sensitive, so you have to do this really slowly, really gently.
Okay.
And what it does is, because the prostate is involved in sperm production, it's involved in ejaculation, it's connected to a man's whole sexual nervous system.
Uh-huh.
It increases the sensitivity of sexual pleasure. For some men, it can actually trigger orgasm as it's been stimulated. And for some men, it will increase the intensity of orgasm enormously.
So it's worth a cursory try at very least.
Absolutely. Well, you know, Gareth, the big thing is that there's an enormous amount of interest in anal sex in general, And a lot of men come along and say, well, this is what I want to do. And I say, well, you have to understand that it needs to be firstly fair for everybody.
Yeah.
And it really can expand male sexual and pleasure possibilities. It can also be very emotional because we hold a lot of emotion there from the past, a lot of hurt, a lot of pain. So it can often come with some big tears, some big emotional release. So be aware of that as well.
Oh, I don't like that.
Well, there's a guy called Chester Maynard. He's not alive anymore. He was kind of the world expert in anal massage.
Huh.
And one of his favorite sayings was, open your ass and your heart will follow.
Well, John T., thank you. I knew you'd give us some value on this Monday morning. And who doesn't want to think about anal pleasure on a Monday morning?
You see, that's the sort of length article I would have expected.
There we are.
So
John T., that's terrific. Thank you for helping us.
Sure. Have a wonderful day, everybody.
Right. There we go. And if you want to hear more, you can always catch John T.'s show, Sex Talk, right here on cliffcentral.com.
Very good.
Yes. Very, very good. All right. So you see, you learn new things every day. Isn't that exciting?
It is.
Do you want to know some other new things? Ben discovered a list of how people die in different countries.
Yeah, quite interesting, actually. There's so many interesting things on YouTube, informative things. But
right.
There's a very definite trend how some countries have experienced death.
So do you want to give us an insight, or should I just play the clip?
The video is very good, guys.
All right. So here we are. Ben found this, and I think it might be interesting for a lot of people. They want to know how it all works, you know, just precisely what countries do what countries what the people in those countries die from, what the main reasons for death are in those countries. So let's get straight to it, shall we? Some mess around. Ben has gone to a lot of trouble to gather this information. He delved deep into the world of how death happens. And I mean, it might make you feel good on a Monday. Who knows? Take a listen.
150,000 people are going to die today.
That's what a great way to start on Monday. Thanks, Ben.
And one of the brutally unfair realities of life is that where you were born can dramatically change how and at what age you die. There's a really fascinating measurement called years of life lost, which measures how many years shy of the realistic maximum life expectancy people die. So if a person can hope to live to age 86, but then dies in a car accident at age 21, those 65 years are considered lost years of life due to car accidents. It's basically a way to measure why people are dying early. Hundreds of researchers from around the world collaborated to collect and analyze that data for each country, and the result is this map. It shows the leading cause of early death in each country for 2013.
All right, so I'm just looking at the map now, and they've got categories like heart disease, pneumonia, HIV, AIDS, malaria, preterm birth, war, stroke, road injuries, and so on. So in our country, quite obviously, it is the HIV, AIDS that is the biggest killer. But in most of the world, all of North America, all of Europe, most of Asia, including India and Russia, not China, it is heart disease. And all of South America, by the way, as well as Australia. So heart disease is definitely right at the top of this list by the look of the map.
And now you'll find out why.
Okay.
Look at Africa. People die early here mainly because of infectious diseases like pneumonia, malaria, and diarrhea, which are easily treated in places with stronger health infrastructures. And people are dying young in these places. 4 out of every 10 deaths in these poor countries are among people under 15.
Ugh.
Meanwhile, in Saudi Arabia... Even though half the population is forbidden to drive, traffic accidents are the number one cause of lost years of life. There's a trend among young guys who see how crazy they can get on the road. Between that and the lax speed limit enforcement, 19 people die every day on Saudi roads.
19 every day. And they do like wheelies on their cars, where their cars are going like night riding, used on two wheels. They're riding on the top of the car, texting.
They watch Fast and Furious 1, and the country's never been the same.
It's the same problem facing young guys in other neighboring countries. Over in Venezuela, 25,000 people were killed in homicides last year, making violence the leading cause of years lost. Only around 8% of crimes are prosecuted, so gang violence usually goes unchecked. It's a similar situation in neighboring Colombia. In Syria, where a bloody conflict rages on, war was the leading cause of lost life. In China, a lot of people are dying from stroke. This is actually an indicator of a major transition in the region. As the economy in China has industrialized and surged over the past 3 decades, infectious diseases like the ones we saw in Africa dropped dramatically due to better health infrastructure. But a stronger economy means eating more fat and sugar, moving less, and breathing a lot more air pollution. Plus, they're living longer. All of these factors increase the likelihood of stroke. Then there's the wealthier countries, where heart disease is the number one cause of early death. Strangely, it's actually the sign of the privilege of old age, since heart disease is generally considered an age-related disease.
Wow.
See, in poor countries, the biggest threat is diseases that kill people early on in life. But in rich countries, death typically comes after a much longer life, even if it's earlier than the life expectancy. So the good news is that overall, years of life lost are decreasing in almost every category worldwide. People are living longer overall. So even though all this talk about death seems kind of depressing, it's actually really good news.
Wow, there we go. Something to think about this morning. How did that make you feel?
Like you want to live in a first world country?
Or like I need to go to a cardiologist and have myself checked out.
Yeah, which is interesting because we're living longer. That's the main reason why that's a cause of death.
I do think that that's really interesting. And the fact that generally the years lost, the years of life lost, which is the measure that they're using here, is decreasing across all categories. Shows you life is getting better. Regardless of what you read in the news and what you hear from politicians, it seems people's lives are improving, even in places that aren't first world and that aren't as well resourced in terms of medicine and healthcare. It's very interesting, it's particularly China, where you can see that they have introduced a lot more healthcare, and the infrastructure in particularly rural areas of China has improved so much. So now they're dying mostly of stroke. So it becomes an age-related thing. It is interesting. I think that's fascinating. All right, well, there's some other stuff that we can get into in a health sense. There are 9 body parts that we no longer need as humans, but you still have some of them.
Okay, which is the first one that comes to mind?
Obviously, your tonsils and your appendix.
Yeah, appendix is the most widely guessed and most commonly known useless organ. Although they are saying that it does play some part in helping digest plants. Also, it's used sometimes to create the stoma or the hole for bladder bags or colostomies, etc.
Because it's basically like a tube that's sealed at one end.
Yeah.
So they open up that end and then they can do things with it. But it is interesting. Like I remember when I studied biology at school, they told us that the appendix in herbivorous animals, animals that eat plants, is primarily there to digest cellulose, which is the stuff that makes plant cell walls.
Yeah, so there you go.
In herbivores, it's particularly important. So vegans, don't get an appendix operation because you might be in trouble.
All that cellulose.
Yeah.
Do you know what the palmaris longus muscle is?
That's the one John T was just telling us about.
No.
Near the G-spot, right?
No, it runs from the wrist to the elbow.
Oh, yeah.
So if you put your hand onto the back of your wrist onto a table.
Yeah.
And then you connect your thumb to your pinky.
Yes.
You see a band of muscle pop up on your wrist.
Right there.
Now,
Ben has it, I have it. Have you got it?
About 10% of the population doesn't have it. I do have it.
How weird.
It was used for helping our ancestors climb trees.
Right, so like a prehensile.
So it helps with grip.
Right.
But then when we started walking on 2 feet, the muscle was rendered useless.
I still got it.
Yeah.
I'm still an ape.
Another thing we don't really need is very powerful jaws. Because
what do you mean you don't need powerful jaws?
Our diets have shifted towards soft foods and cooked grains. Our jaws are also smaller, so we can't all fit in our wisdom teeth properly, and that's leading to the next one, which is the wisdom teeth. We don't really need them anymore.
Yeah, because we're doing less chewing.
Yeah.
Effectively. I mean, we're eating much softer, easier to masticate food.
We're not digging into the leg of a boar with no utensils.
Or chewing the bark off a tree like your ancestors once did. You think you're so special. Imagine them all gathering around a tree, sharing a piece of bark.
Something else we don't really need are erectopili.
I'm sorry?
Erectopili.
They are muscle fibers that produce goosebumps when they contract.
Yes.
So our ancestors, who had a lot more body hair, use these fibers to their advantage, but we don't really have a use for them anymore. I mean, what is a couple of goosebumps going to do, really?
Well, when we had longer hair, it was obviously helpful because it made us look bigger.
Yep.
For starters, so we could frighten away predators.
Like when a cat jumps to the side and fluffs itself out.
Correct. Exactly.
Yeah.
And because it would have helped us to, in a cold situation, to warm ourselves up.
Yeah,
because
it creates a layer of
warm air between the hair fibers and warm ourselves up.
Yeah. So, I mean, it helps in animals like porcupines still, for instance, but definitely not humans.
Very good.
Then we have our tailbone. Human embryos develop a tail between 5 and 8 weeks after conception.
Uh-huh.
That tail then vanishes by the time humans are born.
Right.
And the remaining vertebrae merge to form the coccyx.
That's right.
Tailbone.
That's when someone breaks their coccyx because they sit down on something that hurts them.
Oh, it's a horrible feeling.
You've had it happen?
Yeah.
That's actually your tail. You're breaking your tail.
Yeah. So tailbones helped our ancestors with mobility and balance, but the tail has shrunk as humans learn to walk upright, and the coccyx that we're left with now serves no purpose in humans.
But don't be embarrassed about having a tail.
I'm sorry, I'm embarrassed.
Some people actually do have a
longer
tail
one, yeah.
That doesn't actually get destroyed in the womb like most of us have our tails destroyed. Our bodies actually turn on our tails when we're in the womb. Our immune system destroys it. But in some people it doesn't, and they're born with a proper tail.
Yeah, and it has to be removed.
And then they go to the freak show and they get lifetime employment.
That brings
a
whole new slant on twerking, though.
Yes.
If you've got a tail and you can twerk, it's the real deal.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a bit embarrassing if you end up wagging your tail when you don't really need to or want to.
Yeah.
Like at a funeral.
Imagine you start wagging your tail at a funeral.
Well, that reminds me of moving your ears. Can you move them?
Let me try. Hang on, I'll take off the headphones.
Yes, you definitely
I can. I can move my ears.
Ben?
Only like when I smile, my ears go up. Otherwise, I can't independently move.
I can't move my ears at all. Those are auricular muscles, mm-hmm. and they control the visible part of the ear. But humans have mostly lost the ability to use them.
Well, if you think about a dog or a cat, they can turn their ears to where the sound is coming from. It helps them to position where threats or prey or other things might be.
And I look at my cats sometimes and I think how lazy they are. Because they won't even open their eyes, but they'll flick their ears backwards to hear what's behind them.
That's right.
So, yeah, it's all used to help localize sound and also express emotion to each other, the animals. But since we have very flexible necks, we no longer need to move our ears towards the sounds.
All right.
Then there's the pyramidalis muscle, which
Sorry?
Is located in the lower abdomen, shaped like a triangle.
Mm-hmm.
People have from 0 to 2 of these muscles, but they don't help us at all. They help contract the linear alba, but no longer relevant to the function of one's abdominal muscles.
How's your linear alba?
I never knew I had one before now.
All right. Okay, well, there's a message here about Jonty earlier, because I think a lot of people are very, very excited by what Jonty shared with us this morning about the male G-spot. So here's Mr. Schmangels who says, Jonty's explanation about the G-spot sounds more like my first prostate exam for life insurance, but with me feeling a finger in there and somehow it felt like there was a hand on both shoulders at the same time. Wow, so it's not everybody's favorite thing. All right, well, we've got lots of other stuff we want to talk about, but we may have to save some of that for tomorrow because I want to tell you about something that is, it's a very big story, one that we can be quite excited about. It's telling to have two women who've left their jobs, sold their homes, moved in with their parents, and worked for 4 years just to make a film about rhino poaching. That is some serious commitment to making a positive change. Now, when I heard about this, I had to meet them, especially because the film kept bagging international awards. I want to welcome to the studio this morning Bonnet de Bort and Susan Scott, who are the producer and director of a movie called Struup. Now, the film looks into the dark underworld of rhino poaching, where the need for the horn comes from and how people on the front line of the war are fighting to stop poachers in their tracks. Struup, Struoop, Journey into the Rhino Horn War had its South African premiere on Wednesday, the 21st of November last year. Back in October of 2018, the movie finished its international premiere and had impressive wins in Europe. After leaving the US, they had a win in Boston at the Mystic Film Festival for Best International Documentary. The film started its European premiere with a bang at the Wildlife Film Festival in Rotterdam just a few weeks after, and it was selected to open the festival. So this is by no means just some film or just some passion project for two people. I'm very, very happy you guys are here this morning. Thank you so much for coming to join us, and congratulations on the success of the film so far.
Oh, thank you so much. Oh, lovely to be here.
It's terrific. And this is really quite an extraordinary thing that you've done, because you did give up everything. You stopped what you were doing in order to make this film. Has it been worth it so far?
Yes, definitely worth it. Yes, I mean, we sold our homes, moved in with our mothers at this age.
Did your mother like that, Bonet?
She did. But it would be great to actually move into my own place now. So I hope
she did love it.
Normal life a little bit. So yes, and we quit our jobs with broadcasters and to make this film.
Well, I'm interested in what it was that made you take all these important decisions and commit yourselves to a project like this, because lots of people care about conservation, lots of people care about animals, lots of people care about the plight of rhinos, but none of them really care. I mean, I don't know a lot that care enough to quit what they're doing and put everything at risk. Why so much passion for rhinos in particular?
Well, you know, it actually started, I used to present for 50/50, the environmental show on SABC.
Absolutely.
I produced stories, and Susan produced a story on rhino poaching for the program. And she told me, okay, I had to present the story. We have 12 minutes to tell this very complex war, to South Africans. And we thought, okay, well, let's go film. We went to the Kruger National Park, and the rangers took us to this double carcass. And Susan said to me, okay, Bonnie, sit between these two carcasses and do your lines to camera. And it was actually in that moment where I was just so confronted with all these questions. Firstly, how can humanity be so absolutely cruel? And how can we, as South Africans, allow this to happen? And it was in that moment where I thought, okay, we have to do something more. You know, we have to do something bigger. Oh. And Susan, I think you felt the same way. And
yeah,
we just decided, you know, we have to make an independent film so that we can show all aspects of the crisis.
So I assume in the making of that first feature on the show, you'd already been working in terms of conservation and bringing this information to light before that, Susan. So how was your involvement before you two decided to put the film together?
Well, I had been doing quite a lot of stuff for National Geographic, and there was a chance for me to do this update on the rhino situation for the South African audience. And again, with Bonnet, I think we both were just overwhelmed by the extent of it, because I hadn't, even though we were in conservation, we hadn't really looked in depth at the rhino situation on the ground. And that was back in 2013. And I think for both of us, we were sitting there going, gosh, you know, there's this huge effort on the ground. Surely someone is telling this, right? And I think luckily, because of who Bonnet was, we were able to get access then into a lot of the, because it's very secretive, and obviously people are very worried about, you know, who's going to be watching this film, are they going to see where our rhinos are, and, you know, because if the general public in the world are watching this, then obviously so are the syndicate leaders and the poachers out there and the traffickers. So, it was definitely getting access.
What you're telling me is that where there are rhinos, people are trying to look after the rhinos. They don't want people to know that they are looking after the rhinos, because otherwise the hunters will come, the poachers.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how, first of all, what's the extent of the problem? And I don't mean for you to summarize like you had to in the TV documentary, that you have to summarize something that is so complex. But give us an indication of what you uncovered in making this film, and what most people don't know about poaching, about rhino poaching in particular in South Africa, and about who's behind it, and why we should be worried about this. Because I think for a lot of people, this is really it's a kind of a luxury issue. Mm. It's something that high-minded game farm owners or people who want to go on safari should be concerned about. But this is our national heritage, right?
Absolutely. Mm. I mean, I think that's what we when we were doing this, obviously, you know, we started and we thought it would be 6 months, and it took 4 years by the time we sort of crawled out of it at the end of our odyssey. And I think there is that mindset that this is something that, A, being taken care of, and B, that, as you say, it is a luxury problem. But especially when we came back from Asia and we saw the demand there, and I think we took a lot of risks, which I know Bonnet will go into, but we took a lot of risks that were really stupid for us to figure out and uncover what was happening. When we came back from Asia, there was definitely that mindset with both of us. Wow, in 50 years' time, it doesn't matter who we are, all of us speaking all the official languages in 50 years' time are going to say, what did you guys do? How come we don't have rhinos in the wild? And I think that really, that's been the driving force for both of us.
Absolutely. And also, I think, you know, what we uncovered is the fact that, and I think it's infiltrated throughout the system, corruption is one of the biggest enablers of wildlife crime. We saw it firsthand with rangers, policemen caught for rhino poaching, the very people who should be protecting our heritage. You know, and now elections coming up. Also, there was a very disturbing report yesterday in the Sunday Times about the new environment minister. You know, we have to demand, we have to put pressure on our politicians to stand up for, you know, those without voices, not only our rhinos, but elephants, pangolins. And I know we're all overwhelmed by so many problems in the country, but it is our heritage. Mm. And we have to look at it in a bigger picture. I mean, people, why is this country so beautiful? It's our wildlife. Mm. You know, and
people, they're not coming here to join us in Johannesburg CBD.
Exactly. So they come here on safari. They want to see our big five. Sure. So, you know, we have to, I think as South Africans, we have to take it more seriously.
Mm. All right. So you said that you'd gone to Asia and you'd spent a bit of time, obviously in countries like Vietnam, and you put yourselves at great personal risk. How dangerous did it get?
Well, it was.
I don't think we realized. No. Maybe when we landed back in South Africa, we thought, oh my goodness. Mm. I mean, the risks that we took, and you know, there was this one incident where we were talking to illegal wildlife smugglers, and they said, get into our car. And I remember it was a gold 4x4 Lexus. We'll take it to a factory to see how we carve rhino horn into jewelry and libation cups and that type of thing. And we both just said, oh, okay, let's get into the car.
Jesus. I think we were just so thrilled that, oh my gosh, we're going to see this. We're going to see how
we had capture access,
it and right. capture it on camera, you know, Ooh. To be able to show.
And these guys were kind of very bold about it. They don't seem to have been directly
gangsters. Hey?
Well, I have to just jump
and
in
two
here.
Women on their own.
I think that's why I was just about to say. I think that's why we got the access, because we had our translator obviously with us, and I was posing as Bonnet's kind of agent. So we'd said that she was we'd done a lot of research into all of this, and we'd said that Bonnet was a TV star from Holland who had an absolute love for natural products. So she was dripping with ivory and you know whatever.
I had to wear the product, you know.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Look the part. I can afford it.
Yeah, and your fake Rolex and you were in there. And then we got into this vehicle and
they starstruck, you know. So if you say that you're this famous person from some country, they believe you. You're a celebrity, so it's all selfies.
Well, you kind of are in a way. I mean, you were on TV here, but they just didn't know the right.
Yeah, we didn't have to go into
detail. Thank goodness
they
didn't know that.
Yeah. So I don't think we intimidated them, you know, in too much because we're two sure. women. And and then we got into the car and we were strapped with undercover cameras, buttonhole cameras, and Susan strapped a GoPro to my chest, so you know I couldn't really ditch it if they were to search us. But we are here today, so everything worked out well.
You made it out. And what did you get to see in this factory?
Well, for starters, when we walked in there, we heard all this commotion, all the sawing sound, and as we walked in there, couldn't believe it. There were all these raw elephant. Huge, big ivory tusks that were on the ground, raw, were still with the dirt from Africa on them. And I mean, obviously, if there's ivory in Asia, they say, oh, it's pre all the bans, it's, you know, from the 1970s. This was absolutely fresh.
Mm.
And then the guys also then said, look, we paint the ivory. Look how clever we are. We make it look like wood. And, of course, Bonnet said, why do you do that? And so so we can get it through the ports in Africa so that we can get it into the cargo containers and get it here. So, I mean, they were very pleased with themselves that they backed the system. Mm. And then, obviously, then we saw the carving of the, you know, how they make the cups, because it's quite a status symbol in Asia to have. There's this belief that rhino horn detoxifies you. So if you drink out of, the Chinese men believe this, if you drink your rice wine out of it detoxifies you, and it also will prevent you from having a hangover. So that's, I mean, there's various aspects of the belief in the horn, but that's one of them. And obviously making the jewelry. If you wear a rhino horn bangle, you know, jade bangles are quite big, the natural product, and rhino horn is the most expensive substance on Earth right now, so it's more expensive than jade. Yeah,
And of course, it does nothing. It's just keratin.
Exactly.
I mean, it's the same stuff you've got in your nails and your hair.
Right.
There's nothing special. Let's just be clear about this. There's no magical property to rhino horn.
Nothing whatsoever.
Rhino doesn't even have that much use for it anymore. It was an evolutionary throwback to when a rhino had to defend itself by using the horn as its primary weapon, and of course. That would be against predators, but it's certainly not something that has any special powers. It's ridiculous.
And there's a very strong belief that rhino horn, as Susan mentioned, detoxifies the body. So you have a lot of cancer patients using a combination of chemotherapy and rhino horn. We actually interviewed a patient and an oncologist, and she said a lot of her patients will do it. We'll use it. And then I actually asked this cancer sufferer, and I said, well, when last did you use it? And she said, 2 weeks ago for my granddaughter's fever.
So it's not even being used in the right way.
There's no connection.
According to the cultural belief or whatever it might be. What I'm impressed by, and this is probably why you guys have got so many awards, is you also went to the source of the problem, the demand.
Mm.
People often look at the supply problem, but then there's a demand problem.
Yeah.
Which is probably far more dangerous, because if there's such a demand, they'll find a way to get a supply.
Absolutely. Yep, absolutely. And I think that was when we started, we really thought that this was going to be a story, you know, the boots on the ground, hanging with the rangers, and we had unbelievable access inside Kruger and Imphalozi and to the special ranger units there and the section ranger inside Imphalozi. So that we knew we were very privileged to be able to show that and to be able to bring that to South Africans and to the world. And but when we were there, you know, all across the line, and we spent a lot of time in court with the prosecutors following various cases, poaching cases, traffickers, syndicate cases, and all the time, despite what NGOs and organizations tell you what's happening in Asia, we did feel, well, how are they spinning it? What is their story? Mm. What do they, you know, what's in it for them to say, oh, this is how the Vietnamese are using it. Oh, this is how the Chinese are using it. And we spoke to a lot of undercover filmmakers that worked in the area for many years, one of them being Carl Amun and another South African producer. And they'd actually done a lot of work looking at lion bone trade, tiger trade, and they really helped us a lot with that. So I think, you know, there is that sense in the filmmaking community of you know, with something like this, with wildlife trafficking, helping each other and saying, okay, this is what we have seen. This is the best way to tackle it. And I think that gave us the strength to go into Southeast Asia and to look at it.
Did you have to explain struup to a lot of them?
Yes, and I mean, in America, of course, it wasn't struup; it was stroop.
But even if they look it up, they could find that it's syrup.
Exactly.
They'll be very confused.
So we had to explain that it's the Afrikaans word for poached, but it's actually, there's a deeper meaning behind it. It also means to strip bare. If you strip bare the land, yes, a rhino is poached. You take the physical horn, but you take so much more. You know, you take the iconicness away from the species. Mm. And that's why we decided to stick with the name struup.
And you've explained that to people clearly well enough, and your work here speaks for itself. I mean, we've got the San Francisco Green Festival, a Green Tenacity Award, Santa Cruz Film Festival Spirit of Action Feature Film Award, San Pedro International Film Festival Best Documentary Award, Glendale, La Femme, San Diego Mystic Film Festival, Wildlife Film Festival in Rotterdam, Berlin's Courage Film Festival. I mean, you've really got all the awards here. So are we looking for an Oscar?
Good question.
That is a good question. Look, you know, with it being an independent film, we obviously, I mean, the public helped us tremendously. I mean, they really
Who financed this film?
We used crowdfunding, so we went to the various crowdfunding platforms like Indiegogo and Thunderfund, and we funded it that way. We would make calendars, and the public would then buy the calendars, and then we forward sold digital downloads. So the public were incredible. I mean, they really helped us.
It was a slow process.
Yeah, it was a very slow
process.
That's
amazing.
Yeah, and then we had two organizations overseas, the Tanglewood Foundation and the Oak Foundation, and they deal with wildlife trafficking, and they said, look, you know, you've got to stop selling the calendars and actually get to work. So, you know, why don't we just help you a little bit there? And we had two corporate sponsors here, BKB and Fulmul, who helped us there in the agricultural business. So they also then said, look, you know, what you're doing really needs some help. So, yeah, we've really been supported by the public in this. So,
you know, we didn't want to go the traditional broadcaster route. It's obviously the easier way, but it comes with restrictions.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
Hidden agendas. You can't be too negative about certain things. I won't spell it out, but we all
know. No, of course.
You can't show graphic images.
And the politicians get involved in all kinds of other things. You can't have that.
This is the true, real, raw rhino story. That is what this film is.
That's why we had to go the independent film route, get it into cinemas, and... and do it that way. Obviously, we do have a distributor that has picked it up, and
here in South Africa, you already premiered it last year.
Yes, yes.
And it's still on in cinemas.
Yes, but we're self distributing ourselves because obviously no.
That's tough, huh?
Yeah, this is very tough. I mean, you know what it's like to be independent and go alone. Yeah, it's tough.
They just told us, you know, it's a documentary. No one's going to come to theaters to watch it, and it's a documentary about rhino poaching. So.
But we've had sold out screenings. I mean, PE...
In every major city, yeah.
Yeah, PE last weekend, there were about 30 people that rocked up at the door and they...
had to be turned away.
We made a plan, so yeah.
Wow.
Didn't mind sitting on the aisle.
Is there a possibility you may be nominated for more awards?
Well, we have been nominated for two or three more, which are in February, March. So
yeah, the Hollywood Independent Documentary Awards.
And then in New Zealand, there's one there, and the Impact Doc Awards.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Congratulations. This must feel like it's worth it after all of this.
Yes, absolutely.
Sacrifice and hard work. I mean, it must have been tremendous work. Forget about the sacrifices you made personally. You've been at this nonstop, right?
Yeah, well, look... Gathering the footage was one thing, but then putting it together, oh my word. I come from an editing background, and you know, both of us know how to put a story together, and we were flummoxed. I mean, it took us weeks to figure out a storyline, and I remember, we normally you put the cue cards up against the wall when you're in the edit suite, and we had so many, we had to put them all down on the ground.
And we'd just stare at it.
One day we'd say,
for hours.
This is ridiculous. No, it took us a while, but in the end, I think the story works.
Mm. Wow. I think you're doing a huge service to the country, even if a lot of people aren't particularly grateful for that yet. I think you're doing a huge service to... The world in terms of a species that, as you say, can't speak for themselves. But we tend to forget that this is ongoing and it's happening right here. And it's happening we're meant to be the custodians and the stewards of this world. We seem to be letting down everybody, including ourselves, in terms of what our dereliction of duty with respect to these rhinos. And of course, internationally, there's probably going to be a lot of interest in all of this too. I would imagine that there are a lot of people internationally who've spoken to you since the documentary's come out and have said, how do we get involved? What can we do to help? Perhaps we'll attract some investments in terms of people coming here to help put their money behind conservation.
I mean, you know, a lot of people after the screenings would come to us and say, you know, you always refer to South Africa's rhinos, and it's actually the world's rhinos, you know. So I also realized that, you know, rhinos don't own passports. That's very clear. And, you know, so it's not a fight we have to fight alone. People want to get involved. And so we had definitely a lot of interest in the U.S. and in Europe.
And I think the other thing as well is we always say it's wonderful to attract investment into the country or to get people, you know, especially the Americans, oh my gosh, I want to donate to the orphanages, oh my gosh, that's the rangers, they need our help. But for us, it's very much getting the film seen by the right people. So, for example, today in Hong Kong, the Hong Kong judiciary are going to be viewing the film. They are doing a workshop, and they've obviously expressed interest. We've got a scene in there of a Chinese trafficker that's caught at O.R. Tambo and with three horns from Imphalozi valued at 12.2 million rand, and that's just the South African value. That's not even the value once it hits the black market. And so that's happening now.
So we could see actual change in law. We could see stricter and stronger and more stringent regulation.
We're definitely pushing that.
I'm positive. Absolutely. Yeah. We have to see change in the criminal justice system. We have a system working for the criminal and not for the victim. You know, too many poachers are getting caught for a third, fourth, fifth time. We have a ranger telling us that the biggest slap in his face is when he's tracking poachers, arrest them and realize, but we know these guys.
We've done this before.
And they, you know, they were caught with the horns, with blood on their overalls, with a rifle, with a panga, and here they are poaching again. You know, the traffickers get off with a fine. The syndicates are all out on bail. The cases take 4 or 5 years or longer. So we need to see change there. And I'm positive that this film will help, you know.
Yeah, and I think that's the other thing as well. As you know, what do they say? The wheels of justice turn slowly, but they, you know, when it comes to, I guess, other crime, you know, family members being murdered, eventually you will see justice. But I think with rhinos, and that's exactly what Bonnet is saying, these guys are getting out on bail, and, you know, it's not, we have a finite amount of rhinos.
Yeah.
So,
in other words, this is fairly urgent.
Exactly. So they're going to keep committing these crimes, keep going back out there, and the number of poachers. I mean, you know, you also sit there and you look at our whole system as well, and you sit there. You know, we would sit in court and we would wait. We would go down to Nelspruit Magistrate Court and we'd walk in and we'd go, okay, are we first on the roll of the case that we're following? Oh no, look at that. There are 7 child rape cases before ours, and it hits you, and you sit there and you go, oh my goodness, here we are pushing for rhino poachers to not be given bail, but yet
look at how humans are even treating each other. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm.
God, well, listen, you're both very brave, and I think that this is a terrific success story in terms of certainly the kind of public acclaim that you're getting for the movie. Is there a website we can go to? Is there a place we can find out more about how we could go and see the movie? And we can keep track with what you're doing and where it's being taken up and where people are giving you awards and all of this stuff. Where can we keep following?
No, absolutely. On social media, we've got a Facebook page. You can just type in Struip Film. It will come up. Twitter, at Struip_film. And then our website is www.struip-film.com. And we do all the updates there. The screening's coming up. We have one in Pretoria at Menin Park on the 9th of Feb. We have one in Bloom on the 16th of Feb. And people can buy tickets at any Pick and Pay or online. Tickets.co.za.
Right.
And on the 12th of Feb, the film will be online on Amazon and iTunes. So
superb.
Yeah, so that's around the corner.
Excellent stuff. On Amazon and on?
iTunes.
iTunes, yeah. Very good. All right, well, thank you both so much, Bonnet De Bort and Susan Scott. It's an absolute pleasure to meet you both. Thanks. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Isn't this great?
Fantastic. Really, it's something that I've followed for so many years, having an interest in our wildlife and beyond that, you know, focusing more on pets and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But always in the back of my mind, this has been something that seemed to me to be far too huge to tackle as one broadcaster.
Right.
Mm. And I think it's amazing that it's taken just two to create something like this and that it's been seen in Hong Kong. I mean, just today. That's amazing.
Yeah. And, you know, we're also working with the United Nations Environment Programme, World Bank, to screen the film with them. The UK government asked us to screen the film at the Illegal Wildlife Conference in October. So we're getting it to the right people. You know, the people writing the policies. So
and that's amazing
and
stuff.
Film is a very powerful way to tell these stories, perhaps the most powerful way, because we see news articles and we hear stories and people talk at, you know, social gatherings. But when you actually see this stuff, and as you say, in all its ugly glory, and I don't even like to use the word glory, but in all its violence and its nastiness, I think it will get a lot of people suddenly conscientized to a thing that otherwise was always out there.
Yeah. Mm. You cannot not be moved.
No, yeah. Sure.
And I think those visuals. Yeah, sorry, Bonnie. The South Africans on the ground. I think people are, they believe it or not, there are some humor moments in the film. I mean, people, you know, it's lovely standing in the, you know, at the back and just hearing people absolutely burst out laughing because of the people that they've fallen in love with following the film, because we have incredible South Africans on the ground. And it's wonderful to be able to show the world these people who are doing this for our rhinos.
Well, thank you for telling the story.
Thank you.
There we go. So if you want to hear more, you know where to go. All over social media, you can find Bonnie Debot and Susan Scott. And the movie is called Struip. Find out where you can see it if you haven't seen it already. And pass on the news to everybody else. That's all we got time for today. Let's wrap it up with the news for this morning. Let's see what's going on. All right, first of all, the Equality Report has just been released, and most South Africans are still very poor. Unless they've been on the Basasa payroll, in which case they're very rich. Charlize Theron is apparently dating Brad Pitt. Huh? How do you like that? It's quite fitting, as the biggest movie ever to hit Benoni was, of course, Fight Club. There's a relationship there. And Banyana had a big match over the weekend, but it was unfortunately in front of a very small crowd. SAFA presidents have said that it's only women after all, so what do we expect? But then that's typical of SAFA. All right, have a good Monday. We'll see you tomorrow between 6 and 9. Coming up, our For the Love of Law podcast series with Flaxman's attorneys. You'll get to see behind the scenes what happens in a big law firm. And maybe if you're someone who's interested in the law, it'll give you the kind of insights that you have been looking for. We will see you tomorrow between 6 and 9. Have an excellent day in the company of CliffCentral.com. Be good and blah, 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 blah.
This is CliffCentral.com.